2FM. With Green Fern, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein your way.
Thanks to Jenny Green, it's Monday the 18th of January. It's Pep Guardiola's 50th birthday, and this is Game On.
Well, Pep might have got his birthday present yesterday when Man City won 4-0 and Liverpool and United could only draw. But Stephen Kelly is standing by to talk to us about a title race that might give us something to talk about until Marie's beloved GAA returns in May.
I'm still sticking with Liverpool. I think Liverpool obviously have a difficult spell for them because of the standards they've set for the last few years. Their attacking players are brilliant. We said they've lost their spark, but I think they will get that back.
In tennis, no special treatment for players down under.
Good evening. Victoria is standing firm on hotel quarantine for tennis stars after world number one Novak Djokovic issued a list of demands calling for less time in isolation and private housing.
Plus, we've our weekend sporting highlights, and in rugby, why South Africa have not given up on a Lions tour just yet.
Game on 2FM.
You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. So I was kind of reading the papers this morning, guys, and rummaging through, thinking, what'll their highlights be? And I said, Marie will definitely have one out of left field because there's no way she's going to mention Liverpool. But I was thinking, what is Dunica going to come up with? This is going to be interesting. What was your highlight of the weekend, Dunica?
I think the fact that I got through it, Ruby, that's the only possible highlight I can have. Sports-wise, it was very light in the ground for me. I suppose I was looking forward, like us all, to watching the Man United Liverpool game and hoping that would throw something out. But in rugby, it was very, very quiet. There was a good win. Look, this is actually quite sad. For the Ealing Trailfinders, actually beat Saracens, which was a bit of a shock. You know, the championship isn't back yet and they've organised to play each other. So Ealing managed to come out on top and beat Saracens. But I was there. You want to have a look at yourself here, Dunners, if you're taking this as a bit of a result. There was a good win for Glasgow over Edinburgh, and we'll be chatting to Ben Coles about the incidents and that later on. But yeah, for me it was light. Ruby, what about you? Did you have
I went to Punchestown yesterday, Dunica, like everybody else interested in racing. Well, I went to Punchestown, nobody else, not everybody else could go, but to watch Asturian for Lange take on Envoy Allen in receipt of £11, and that lasted all of about 23 seconds. First by the time Asturian Challenge fell at the first, and it was race over as Envoy Allen just strutted his stuff. But he showed how brilliant he was again, and even with a couple of loose horses in the race, Sempo and Asturian Falange continued on loose throughout the whole race, and they were over and back in front of him. But for such a young horse to show his professionalism, he never even looked at them. And horses are a little bit like sheep. They do tend to follow after the others, but he just knows his job and he's so professional, and he put in another brilliant performance yesterday.
On Friday, Jane Mangan was going on about Real Deal, and I'd say myself and Dunica paid no heed whatsoever.
And you know what? And you know what's worse? Like, even if you just happened to turn on the racing yesterday at about 20 past one and remembered what Jane Mangan had said, he drifted all the way from 7 to 1 to 22 to 1 at the off. Imagine you were told that, but he sat there in the studio and you just didn't even listen.
Thanks, Jane. See you. We'll chat to you next week. And what? Yeah, went to the
yeah,
we
thank
went.
God. That's racing over and done with again. Whew, no. Do we make a mistake? I'm telling you. If you could just listen.
Okay, that's it. From now on, we're listening to Jane.
Yeah, listen to Jane. Don't be listening to me.
Here's resolution. Sorted.
Yeah. Marie, what about you? Had you a highlight?
Yeah, I didn't really have a highlight. It was more of a bit of a sense of relief. I think everyone was following Breed Stack's incident at the weekend. For anyone that missed it, she suffered a really worrying neck injury, making her debut for the Great Western Sydney Giants on Sunday. It was a practice match against the Adelaide Crows, and she was injured. And at the time, it looked really, really bad. You know, when there was she was taken to hospital, and there was a lot of speculation that it was a serious back or neck injury. So everybody was very, very worried about her, and you could see Cora Staunton standing beside her and all the worried faces. And obviously she's a very long way from home, and it was just a really, really nasty collision, but it looks like she's going to be okay. Their club tweeted that she's going to make a full recovery. She's been released from hospital. What she ended up having was a fracture of the C7 vertebrae. Ruby, you're probably more familiar now with that than I would be, but all the accounts seem to be that she's going to be alright. So that was my highlight, really, just knowing that she was going to be okay.
I think there's a massive word missing from what you said there, Marie, and that's it's a stable fracture of the C7 vertebrae, which is huge. If you think about where your spinal cord is and the difference between a stable and unstable fracture, especially in vertebrae, is massive. An unstable vertebrae fracture would have to be operated on to be stabilised, and anytime you're operating in an area like that, it also always carries risks. But a stable fracture is a big difference, and it's a huge result for her.
It was great to see the best of care given to her, but then seeing Cora Staunton actually standing over like a sister, you know, just looking out for her, even pulling up the blanket, there's an image of her kind of just looking out for her. And there's times when you're injured and that's what you need. You're so worried, you're so nervous, you're seeing all these people around you kind of getting into certain positions. But he would have done it a fair bit, Ruby, looking out for fellow jockeys, looking out, you know, visiting people in the hospital.
Yeah, that's human instinct, Donica. Mm. That's people you work with or anything, of course you have a natural reaction to try and look out for them. But I do know I did fracture C5, which is a bit above C7, and I did T7 as well. But the most frightening part of it is how your body reacts and the shock that breed might have gone into, and it affects your breathing, and that is what's so frightening about it. You think, God, am I suffocating? What's wrong with me? Like, a stable fracture would have meant she had full movement of her limbs, but the fright would be trying to get her breathing back under control, and that's the scariest part of it.
And Ruby, then at what stage do you start thinking about getting back? So like, Breed is someone who's travelled all the way across the world to extend her playing career and to have a professional career. So at what stage then do you think, okay, do you park, okay, that was really scary and the shock, and you start thinking about, okay, when can I get back, when can I recover, what does it take, how long does that take to set in?
Well, I'd imagine, just watching the pictures, Marie, so she was lying on the pitch and they would have, the care she had, straightened her up and steadied her up and probably administered some sort of pain relief to her. Maybe not with a neck injury, they mightn't have given her too much because they wouldn't want her body to relax that much. But I'd say once she got to the hospital and they told her what it was, she probably processed in her own mind, and I'm only talking about how I would have done it, processed in my mind, well, that's okay, that'll fix. So how long? And I have no doubt that that's probably the same question every professional athlete asks. How long? She'll have asked the doctors, what would a C7 fracture, stable fracture, sort of 8 to 10 weeks, maybe 12 weeks, depending on age and how quick her body recovers. But that's what she's looking at, and I'd say that's what she's thinking about.
Have you had something quite similar?
Yeah, I did C vertebrae, and I did 3 T vertebrae, which is your mid thoracic, which is below your neck. C is your neck, T is your back, and then L is your lumbar spine. So I had fractures in C's and T's, and T's were probably sore, C's were probably more dangerous. But you're thinking, I did one the last year I was riding and I didn't tell anybody because I was already getting, oh, he should retire and he needs to retire and how much more can he take? So I kept saying I'd broken ribs, but I actually had a fracture in a vertebrae in my neck, and I was out for probably 9 weeks with bruised ribs, which probably raised the flag in itself because I probably was never out for bruised ribs in my life. But that's all I kept saying, that I had bruised ribs, but it was a fracture in the C vertebrae.
These fractures, whatever about them, Ruby, nerves and the nerves around them is where it can get complicated.
Exactly, but that's the difference between stable and unstable. Because it's stable, and my limited medical knowledge, I'm only talking about my own body, I'm not a doctor or an orthopaedic surgeon or a neurosurgeon, and I would be corrected by any one of them. But by being stable, it means it hasn't moved to damage the nerves, is my understanding of it. And that's what I took from talking to doctors. So that is the big difference. So hopefully there's no damage there.
But the big concern, Marie, like you're saying, is that she gets out there as quickly as possible. You know, going over, like we always do refer to age as well. You know, it's not like she's left it early in her career and come back. She's going out there with a name, 11 All-Ireland. She's put it all on the line, and you'd like to see her togging out as quickly as possible with the medics.
Yeah, the issue over there, though, is the season is quite short now. They did extend it a bit, but I know for the last few years it had only been around the 12-week mark, so by the time she probably gets back, it'll probably be nearly gone. But from what I gather, we had her on the show a little while ago, herself and her husband have taken career breaks, so look, they might give it the year, give it another year, who knows?
She might get back to next year. She went through all that quarantine. Yeah. We were talking to herself and Marcock, was that her husband's name? Marcock? Her husband? Carl, I'm really sure it is. Yeah, and like, they were heading into quarantine with a baby, the three of them in the rooms. We know about the tennis stars, what's happening to them at the moment. It was no different for Breed Stack and her family. So I'd say there's a fair chance they might give it another year.
And also look at Cora Staunton. Like, Cora Staunton is at the peak of her powers, and she's a little bit older than Breed, and she's just showing what you can do, and that age is just a number. And likewise, all the Irish girls out there are just showing how quickly that they can adapt to the game as well. So I'm sure that, look, Australia wouldn't be a bad place to be for a year anyway, I'd say, waiting for the season to come around. So we are going to take a quick break, and then, as Ruby just mentioned, there is a lot of drama with the tennis players in Australia in quarantine. So we'll be back to chat to Conor Nyland after this.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Green Fern's new on-the-go chicken bites are natural, high in protein, and packed with flavour. Game on 2FM.
People are free to provide lists of demands, but the answer is no. And that was very clearly put, that was very clearly laid out beforehand. So the notion that there's been any change, the notion that people weren't briefed, I think that argument really has no integrity whatsoever. And don't just take my word for it. You've got other players who I think on social media and in other forums have made it very clear that they were clear on the rules. I probably can't be any plainer than that. We've got a very clear set of rules and guidelines. Tennis Australia and the tour and both tours and the ITF beyond that, I think they're all engaged in this. This is a no surprises thing, and whilst people might prefer to do it differently, that was not what the public health advice said was safe, and that's not what's been put in place, and we're not changing that.
Now, that was Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews. He was asked about whether the tennis players stuck in isolation in their Melbourne hotel rooms ahead of the Australian Open should be given any special treatment. He was asked about a series of requests reportedly made by Novak Djokovic, including a reduction in the time spent in isolation, permission to see coaches, and moving athletes to private houses with practice facilities. We are joined now on the line by former professional tennis player Conor Nyland. So, Conor, should they just keep quiet and get on with it, do you think?
I think demands there is probably the key word in a lot of this today. Novak Djokovic, who incidentally isn't in full 24/7 quarantine like a lot of the players are, he's actually in Adelaide about to play an exhibition tournament, and he's able to get out of his room for 5 hours every day to practice, and he's got a balcony, etc. So he has taken it upon himself to be a player spokesperson here and ask for, or demand, however way you want to say it, a list of things that he thinks will make the players' lives easier. Now, the reason he's doing this is he set up a new players' association just before the US Open last year. So he's sort of trying to play the professional players' spokesperson, and I don't think all the players are on board. Some of them are. But not all of them. But it's been an interesting couple of days on social media.
Djokovic, and he is one of the most famous sports people in the world. But is he not looking at the bigger picture here and all the Australians that can't get home and all the ordinary people that have to do quarantine? Is he trying to make himself too elite? Can he not see the bigger picture? I mean, that's not a fair question to ask you, but looking at it, it just doesn't look like a fair demand to make.
No, I agree. I think he's read the room badly. Again, almost trying to be a spokesperson, and he's sort of one of these people who seems to keep putting his foot in it. And there's sort of a body of work over the last year where he kind of, even if he's probably almost thinks in his own head he's doing something for the benefit of the players, he still doesn't come out looking very good. And obviously you've got Bernard Tomic, an Australian player who happens to be in quarantine because he was playing in qualifying in Doha, talking about he had a bad lunch. His girlfriend was saying that she had never washed her own hair.
Actually, Conor, I have that please clip if you want to hang on for 1 second.
Please play.
This is the worst part of quarantine. I don't wash my own hair. I've never washed my own hair. It's just not something that I do.
That raises so many questions.
I mean, obviously, you guys, even before the break there, talking about spinal injuries, I think that, you know, puts it into context pretty strongly of what a sports person has to deal with in terms of true sacrifice and what this is. So I think a lot of the players apparently there was a series of calls between Tennis Australia and the players leading up to this, and some of the players have said it was really crystal clear that, look, if there's any positive cases on any of these flights coming into Australia, anybody on those flights is going into a hard two-week quarantine. If your flight happens to be clear, everyone tests negative, then you're fine, you're going to be able to practice. So some of the players are able to practice in Melbourne because their flights were okay, but some of, about 75 players are in this hard lockdown. So again, it was made clear to the players, they're all getting breakfast, lunch, dinner, they're getting, I think, €100 spending money on food if they don't like what they're getting from the room service. So I think Craig Tiley, who's the head of Tennis Australia, is a highly competent, well-liked guy who has managed to have this Grand Slam at the ends of the world. It's always a difficult trip for anybody getting down to Australia at the start of the year. It's an awkward flight, etc. There's jet lag, all these things. But these players are getting, I think, guaranteed €100,000 minimum prize money, which is up a lot over the last couple of years. So I think most of them are thankful, but I think a couple of them weren't 100% on the rules, found themselves put in their rooms for 2 weeks, which isn't pleasant, obviously. And then they had a phone at the end of their at the end of their hand, and they were tweeting out to the world various things that came out to look a bit unfortunate. So I would have thought over the next couple of days it's going to blow over, the players are going to go quiet again, and hopefully we can start talking about the tennis when it starts in a couple of weeks.
I'm very curious about Djokovic, just how he's perceived it within that elite tennis world that you used to inhabit. I did see Nick Kyrgios tweeting, all right, and he called him a tool, but what does everybody think of him within the tennis world?
He's a bit of a knight in shining armour for some of the players, because he set up this new players association that I was referring to, that's supposed to be driving more prize money for the players. So he's got, anybody outside the top 30, top 40, he's a bit of a hero. And again, he's jumped into that role, or so he thinks, with this set of demands. But the general public will look at it and see that he's, again, he's kind of putting his foot in it. He was obviously ran the Adria Tour event in the middle of COVID last summer, and a number of players got infected. And then he was also talking about not being sure about getting a vaccine or not. I think he was talking about, changing water molecules through the power of positive thought. So again, this is all in the last 12 months when there hasn't even been that much tennis, and he hasn't even been interviewed that often. And he still managed to come out with clangers sort of every month, and this is yet another one. So it's almost like the Djokovic show before the start of every Grand Slam. Not to forget, he got defaulted at the US Open for hitting a linesperson with a ball. So it's just been, I think the deeds of the last year are sort of speaking for themselves. Whereas Nadal obviously is keeping his head down. He arrived, he's playing the same event in Adelaide that Djokovic is, turned up with the face mask, kept the head down, and hasn't said anything. Now, you could argue both ways. Okay, Djokovic is trying to help the players and try and improve their situation, even though he's not involved in the 24/7 quarantine. But again, it's just, he's coming out with some sort of dodgy stuff all the time, basically. So again, it's, as I said, it's sort of a body of work here.
Yeah, Conor, just on that point, for the 72 players that are in that type of a quarantine, have they left it a little bit late now? We see them practicing, actually hitting balls in their room and doing agility the best they can, but with the tournament hoping to start on February the 8th, it's a little bit, are they going to be undercooked?
Yeah, it's only a couple of weeks, so a lot of those players were playing either the qualifying event in Doha, so obviously they just arrived as quick as they could. Some of them were playing some warm-up events, but obviously all the chartered flights arrived at the same time. So everybody is going to be in Australia essentially for the same period of time. But obviously a Djokovic, a Nadal, Osaka, a Halep, they're all in Adelaide and are getting 5 hours practice a day and some matches. And then the other players who aren't in quarantine are able to practice for a couple of hours a day as well. Now, apparently there were some practice sessions today that were postponed and didn't happen because they couldn't clean the minibuses. So there's lots. It's an incredibly difficult operation, I would have thought, for Tennis Australia to get everything right along the way. And I would have thought, over the next 3 weeks, we're going to see something else happen, whether it's a positive case, hopefully not. But I feel like there's going to be something that's going to come up over the next couple of weeks. But it's a tough one to manage.
Andy Murray, do you think we're going to see him participating in the Australian Open after his positive test for coronavirus? I know he said he'd like to get there, but all this drama, you just have to think, is it worth it nearly at this stage?
Yeah, look, I don't know. I don't know enough about the rules in terms of what we know. I think he announced a few days ago that he's got it. I don't know how long, he's allowed travel and bits and pieces, so I doubt it. He was supposed to play Delray Beach in Florida, didn't do it, and now he's got the positive test. So my guess would be no on that. So, it's sort of Nadal and Djokovic are the big two guys, and Dominic Thiem. Again, it's a little bit, I would have thought, frustrating for the players who are in Melbourne watching the guys who are already favourites for the event, kind of in this bubble in Adelaide, practicing together, getting time outside. I think Tennis Australia have some questions to answer in terms of putting that event on. Just the optics of it, the favouritism, I don't think is fair. And I don't know what the conversation was in terms of getting the very top players to come. I could imagine potentially a Nadal or a Halep, who I think was positive, maybe didn't want to come. And they've said, well, look, let's put on a tournament for you. We'll make it slightly easier. I don't know if that happened. But again, there's some sort of favoritism, I think, going on there for the top players, which isn't nice to see. And it's a bit of a, it's a theme we see a lot in tennis. There's seeds locker rooms at the US Open. All the players were, all the seeded players were allowed in the marketing suites around the centre court, whereas the non-seeded players just were in the regular locker rooms. So that's kind of a common theme we see in tennis. So it's a shame to see that sort of favouritism here for this tournament as well.
Obviously, Conor, there was qualifications in Doha. Any names crop up there that maybe we could be looking out for when the tournament does start?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. A chap from the US, a guy called Michael Moe, his mum's from Monaghan, believe it or not, and he's qualified in. He plays under the US flag. We tried to reach out to him a few years ago and see if he would think about changing allegiances, but he'll be an interesting one to follow. A really talented young American guy. He's about 21 or 22, so a little bit of Irish interest there. But I think Djokovic has won this thing. I think it's 8 times, and is in, in Adelaide, and looking pretty good in terms of his preparations compared to a lot of other players. So I think he'll be really tough to beat. And again, with Halep and Osaka down there as well, I wouldn't be surprised if the two winners come out of that very small pool of players in Adelaide.
It must be hard for the players mentally, just being in the quarantine in their hotel rooms, hitting balls off the wall, and then seeing some players out in Adelaide being able to get out.
Imagine being in the room next door.
one of the players, one of the Russian players, Putintseva, had a mouse in her room. So she was... Again, she tweeted or whatever, Instagrammed a video of a mouse, like the quickest mouse I've ever seen. Right? She had it, and she ran under the curtain unbelievably fast. And her comment was like, "I called down to reception 2.5 hours ago, and nobody wants to come up." Because they were scared of the mouse and was quarantined. But it looks a little bit amateur, the whole thing, when you've got these players just sort of tweeting and Instagramming what they're doing in their hotel rooms. It's tough. And obviously, Rob Kearney would have gone through it there the last couple of weeks, him going over to Perth. I don't know what his lead-in time is and when his season sort of gets underway. But as you say, we've got a really fast turnaround. These guys are literally hitting balls against a mattress, don't get any fresh air for 2 weeks, and then they've got about 7 days, and they're going to be playing in the heat in Australian summer. So it's a big ask, and I hope, I think the players are doing 3-4 workouts a day in their rooms, just obviously because they've got so much time in their hands. So I think they'll probably be okay, but hopefully there aren't any issues in terms of fatigue and that in the first couple of days if we get really hot weather.
Yeah, well, that's for sure, Conor. They've given us lots of entertainment over the last 24 hours anyway, so we'll be grateful for that. And thanks so much to you as well for taking our call. We're going to take a quick break.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Fuel your day the healthy way with Green Farm on-the-go chicken bites. 100% natural and packed with protein.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Actually, you're listening to Conor there talking about the players in Sydney or in Melbourne and Adelaide. But when Willie Mullins sent horses down to the Melbourne Cup and talking to David Casey and Rachel Robbins when they got out of the 2 weeks quarantine in Sydney, It was just to get fresh air. It wasn't even to be free again. It was to get out of a room and just to have fresh air. So, like, we've seen watching the tennis players doing it, and we saw Rob Carney, but there's thousands of people doing it, yeah. Locked up for 2 weeks, bang in a room. And I think Novak Djokovic has read that completely backwards. Okay. What sort of an ego is he?
But putting him in charge of the Players' Representative Union or whatever.
But he set it up himself, though.
Okay. Yeah.
So he was going to put himself in charge because he did that. But in fairness, he's been reading the room wrong on a lot of things for a very long time.
Big style. But anyway, let's read the room on something else. Stephen Kelly's on the line. You called it Man City. Go on, tell us.
No, I don't know. I just had a sneaky, well, not sneaky feeling. I've just been watching them of late, and they just seem to be, like I said, they've been gathering steam for a while, and the weekend was a bit more like the old City. Big display, a lot of goals, and they just seem to be, they seem inevitable. They seem like they're going to win games. Every game they go into, you feel like they're going to win it. And like I said, it's been coming for a while now. They've been creeping up the table, and it looks like they're about to probably leapfrog everybody again. But it was, you know, another good performance from them.
The crazy thing about it is, though, that they're really doing it without a world-class striker. I've seen today they were starting to talk about replacing Aguero, not because he's injured or he hasn't been playing, just even the succession line. But right now they just don't seem to have someone. But they're still, as you said, creeping up the table and taking everybody by surprise.
Yeah, it's. I think it's the way they've gone about it. I think last season, the huge factor for City was they were conceding goals. They were getting counter-attacked on, and their people were breaking their front press, that initial quick press that they'd had. They were breaking that, and then they were vulnerable at the back. They fixed that this season. They seem much sturdier at the back. They seem, you know, capable of keeping clean sheet. But then, and everybody's shipping him a goal. Like I said, Aguero's not there, but they've not been scoring 5 and 6 every game. They scored 4 the weekend, which is a bit more getting them back to speed, but they've been winning 1-2-0, and they've just been, you know, unstoppable for the last few games. And like I said, not conceding goals has really helped them, would help any team. But at the moment, I just feel like they're just getting into real stride.
And even some of the quality of some of the goals of the weekend, I mean, Sterling's free kick, Gundogan's goal, they were just cracking goals as well.
Oh, and then De Bruyne, you know, listen, the assist king,
100th assist
he put in. Oh, it's unbelievable. What, like, he is an absolute just outstanding footballer, technically just so gifted, but then he's able to run with the ball, he can read situations, his passing is unbelievable, but inside the foot, outside the foot, like he steps up and he just whips that outside of his right foot, and he puts it on an absolute play for Stones, who again, another player who's come into form and really stepped up this season. So, you know, they've got a lot of people firing well.
I suppose it is probably time to move on to the game that really disappointed when you think about it, because we were building up to it nearly all week, Manchester United and Liverpool. But in hindsight, Stephen, it's probably the result we should have expected.
Yeah, well, I think when expected, I think we would have maybe expected that, but maybe with more goals in it. I don't think anybody expected either team to keep a clean sheet, especially with the back four. Like, you know, I think most people would have thought both those front threes are capable of scoring goals against the back fours they're playing against. That just didn't happen. It's a bit more of a stalemate. I think, you know, Liverpool makeshift back four, United got to be good. They didn't try and take advantage of that more. They were happy to sit back and kind of counter-attack. Liverpool kept possession better, missed a couple of decent opportunities in the final third, not clear-cut chances, but just getting into good areas. Klopp obviously annoyed with the Mane one when he's going through. I'm sure Ruby was delighted with that when he blew the whistle.
Good call.
But I just, you know, it was one of those games. But I just still feel Liverpool have a bit more to offer in that goal. I think Manu have been excellent up to now. Fernandes has been very good, but I think Liverpool can get back into a bit more regular form scoring goals, and if they get some more defensive stability, I think they can kick on slightly more than what they have been.
What do you think is going on with that front three? Like, obviously Mane and Salah, they both had COVID tests, and you just don't know what are COVID positives, and you just don't know what is left, or what, you know, what comes with that. But is it just a question of balance? You know, are they less inclined to kind of push forward because they have to protect that makeshift back four, and, you know, Salah has to create his own chances now?
Well, it's funny. I spoke a bit about this when Van Dijk went down. I said, you know, I think Liverpool were much more equipped to cope with Van Dijk going than what they were when he first came into the team. But I think the knock-on effect of what that has of him being not there and Gomez, the way Liverpool play, they play really high up, so they keep a high line, and the back four has to be very quick in it. And if you have someone like Van Dijk in your team, that allows someone like Trent Alexander-Arnold as a fullback, which I know when you play with a centre-back that is exceptional, and you feel completely comfortable and free to go forward as often as you want. his assists have not been the same, and that's a direct result of him not been playing against with a better centre back. And you know, the fullbacks have been as influential, and that has been a huge part of Liverpool's game. They influence the forward players. The forward players come inside, link up more. It's a knock-on effect of the centre backs, and I know that sounds like a big thing, but I really feel that's what's happened.
Stephen, would it have anything to do? I know there's been injuries, but losing Jota, that competition for places between that front three, if they're all going out and have to perform, or they're missing, you know, someone like him.
Yeah, I think his initial impact when he came in was exceptional. I don't think anybody expected him to come in and do what he did when he first joined the club. So, you know, for him to actually push him for a starting place in that front three, which kind of blew us all away. And yeah, competition for places does make a difference. But I do think it's more the fact that they're just not getting the same sort of level of quality up to them, because the fullbacks have been hampered in their performances. And I genuinely think that their fullbacks are such an influential part of the game, and it's been slightly dampened of late because of they have to be more defence-minded with the makeshift back four that's going on.
We keep talking about that makeshift back four, and if you just apply that to the game at the weekend, was it a missed opportunity for Manchester United then, because they are a makeshift back four, and you just see that, you know, they were missing the Fabinho and Henderson in midfield, and you saw as well, I think in that game, how much they needed them. But did Manchester United, were they a little bit too passive really when you think of the vulnerabilities?
Yeah, absolutely. That's, at the start of the call, I think I just said that Manu, even though they were reluctant to go really gung-ho and after them, I don't think Manu's thought at the moment. They're more of a counteracting team with the pace they have, but you would have felt that this is definitely a missed opportunity. Their front three with Fernandez in there and Pogba, with the quality they have on the ball and with the pace they have, they definitely would feel this was a missed chance to take points and score goals against a team who defensively are at probably their weakest. If you have the two centre midfield players out of the midfield and into the back four, that totally changes it. That changed City for a whole two seasons when Fernandinho was out of midfield and went to centre back. That changed completely how Man City operated with him out of the midfield. You think of how influential Henderson has been and Fabinho in the midfield. Listen, Thiago is, I think, an absolutely wonderful footballer. I think he's one of the best passing midfielders around. But Henderson and Fabinho have been influential in that midfield role, and I just feel taking them out of there and having to set the back, man, you definitely missed the trick.
Stephen, the beauty of this season is if Leicester win tomorrow night in Chelsea, they'll be top, and then Man City could be top on Wednesday night, and on the 6th of February, which isn't that far away, Liverpool play Man City. I mean, this is just, there's so many permutations here, and even Spurs, who were good at the weekend, they're still there. I mean, I know City are the ones with the upper hand, but that game against Liverpool on the 6th of February, that's going to be massive.
Oh, huge, absolutely huge. And what's so lovely at the moment, there's so many teams in it, but they're all playing each other relatively soon, so there's loads of hopping over each other, and like this you know, the stereotypical six-pointers, as we call them, but there's so many of them happening of late. So just, and as a neutral, if you're watching this, not that we're neutrals, but if you're watching it, it's a fascinating watch in comparison to last season, where it was just a runaway, and we're just like, just give them the title. You know, at this stage, we were just happy to hand it over, because you just felt Liverpool were clear-cut winners. And before that, it was like a two-horse race with City and Liverpool. Now there's so many teams in contention, it makes it much more interesting. If any, like I said, any neutral watching it, it's a great league to be fixed on, because anybody can be at the top. Even though I still think it's going to be City and Liverpool at the end of this all, I still think they're the ones to watch.
So out of the chasing pack then, like realistically, who do you think are the team or teams that could challenge for that title as it stands now?
Honestly, I genuinely think that the only people that are going to be, I think it'd be close. I don't think it's going to be like a big point gap at the end, but I think it's going to be down between Liverpool and City at the end of it. That, I think I said this from the start, and it's weird that even though at the start of the season we're almost getting to a point where we're starting to write City off, even though it was seemed unquestionable to do that. But now with the way they're playing, and I just think the mindset that these players have, these teams have, the winning mentality that they have set in place because they've won this competition over the last few seasons, they know what it takes. They know, you know, when you get to the end, those big games, you know, even Liverpool drawing in Manchester United, that's a good result, even though it was at Anfield. That was a decent result for them in all circumstances, considering the players they have missing, where they are. It still keeps them in the hunt. But I think City are the ones to watch, I really do.
You obviously have experience of being at Spurs, and I thought it was quite interesting just hearing Roy Keane talking about Gareth Bale and potentially that Mourinho doesn't really want him. What do you think?
Yeah, it's hard to know who made that signing. Like when he came in first, and I just thought to myself, listen, if you can get Gareth Bale, that is 60% of the Gareth Bale that was at Tottenham when he first arrived, or that when he was in flying form, you're going to have a player that can definitely impact this squad. And just on the team sheet, if you know Gareth Bale starting, that's straight away, that's a warning shot to one of the teams. You know, you look across, you think, well, Champions League winner, capable on his day of doing anything. So you feel like it's a huge player to add to your squad. And at the moment, it doesn't seem Mourinho is willing to play him. And I think it's down to fitness levels. I just feel Mourinho wants his players to be full tilt all the time, really energetic, up and down the pitch. And I just don't think he feels like Bale can give that to him at the moment without breaking down. And, you know, as much as he would like to have him full fit and playing, I think if he can't achieve the levels Mourinho wants from him, he won't play him. That's what manager is. He's not afraid of, I suppose, forcing people's egos or playing people because of reputations. He plays people based on what he feels is best for his system and best for his team, which is why he's a top manager, I suppose.
Stephen, do you really think Tongi Ndombele meant that lob?
I do think he did, actually. Yeah, there's a few that we got on the goal a few weeks ago that I was like, no chance. I think it was Saka off Arsenal, and maybe because of an Arsenal player, I said no, he definitely didn't mean that. And Ndombele, I think he did. I think, yeah, he kind of has a little look over his shoulder, catches the well, and I don't think there was anybody in the box really for him to cross it to either. So it looked like it was a cheeky one. Actually, Dean Ashton scored one years ago in the Premier League, probably almost better than that. But it was a wonderful finish, and like I said, Tottenham, it was a very good performance from them.
A lot of reports as well that Chelsea might be chasing Haaland. Not sure about that, really.
They could do with him.
You think all the money they've already spent, are they going to go again now and break the bank once more, as we keep saying they keep breaking the bank?
I think if anybody will, Chelsea probably will. You know, they, I suppose they went one window without spending, so they're probably thinking, well, this is like two windows in one go we have now, so let's just go for it.
Do they need him, do you think?
I don't know. Listen, does anybody need Haaland? Yes. If he can come in and do what he's doing at Dortmund, everybody would take him. At the moment he is a phenomenal goal scorer. He's pacey, he's quick, he's strong, he's so young. You know, he's probably only going to get better. So I think any team in the world would probably take him. I want them. Do they need them?
And can Frank get the best out of him is another question, because he's not getting the best out of the players that he has.
I think that's more of the question. That's more of the question. Are they buying another superstar to try and just bring in and add to the list to try and make them a better team, or is he actually trying to buy a player that he knows is going to fit into a formation he wants to play? And I think that's the problem. No one knows, Frank hasn't shown to us what his best system is and what his best team is yet, or, you know, a specific way to actually trying to play. And I think that's the probably frustrating part, you know, just trying another superstar into that won't exactly fix it. You know, he might throw loads of goals in and make it look better, but, you know, is he going to show what Frank is actually capable of doing as a manager? Not really, I don't think.
And Stephen, I mean, Chelsea don't have a game in hand. They're on 29 points. I mean, look at the table. They're the biggest team that you could say, they're out of it. Like, how long is Frank going to get?
I think we have discussed before. I think he'd get longer than anybody else would get because of his status at the club. And not that I would buy him that much time, but buy him a bit longer than normal. And the fact that he had a window where he couldn't buy players, and then they lost arguably one of the best players that the club has ever seen in Hazard, and one of the most influential for the last few seasons. So they're still reeling from that. But the money he spent, and with the chairman he has, the chairman expects results when you spend money. That's the way he operates. That's the way he's operated throughout his whole ownership of Chelsea. And if Frank doesn't produce that, if he doesn't get Champions League spots at least this season, then you would kind of feel the start of next season is going to be a lot of pressure. But the talks of them bringing in a more experienced assistant manager, like I think that Avon Grant has been linked with the club and people like that, to put into the background, I suppose, to kind of steady the ship slightly and give him a bit of experience, which might not be a bad decision from someone like Abramovich.
Speaking about managers under pressure, Newcastle play tonight, they're taking on Arsenal. How do you see that going?
It's hard. I know Steve very well, worked for a long time, and he's been under pressure since he took that job. He hadn't even kicked the ball and they wanted him out, so it was a bit of a poison chalice for him, but it was something that he's willing to take on, and he's supposed to be man enough. they're not playing great football. They're up and down. They've had their injuries. They've had a long list of injuries and COVID cases as well. But you know, they're not inspiring anybody at the moment. And you kind of just feel that Arsenal are starting to get their act together a bit more, and you kind of feel they're going to have too much for Newcastle.
Before we let you go, I have to ask you about Celtic, because it was confirmed today by Neil Lennon that another player had tested positive, but he reacted really angrily and hit back at the criticism after that trip to Dubai that there's been so much talk about it. But I have to say, it was an absolutely remarkable press conference. If anyone didn't see it, it's worth checking out. He just pointed the finger at everybody that he could possibly point the finger at. He said they didn't abuse any privilege, that they had a little bit of a drink in the afternoon, and that's completely allowed. They didn't, that they came back to a barrage of hypocrisy. What do you think of all of this that's been going on at Celtic?
I think, listen, in the middle of a global pandemic where you're told not to leave and travel, to go and take your team off to a warm winter training is complete and utter madness, I think. I can't understand the logic behind it. I've done it with teams, I've gone training camps with teams, I've been at where we've done this, but you do it at the right time, when everything's going on, and then to come back under that much pressure, and then was it the 18s were furloughed, or they're one of the academy teams have been furloughed since then. When you look at that and you think the money they would have spent on this trip, and then to come back and have a team furloughed, you just think it didn't make with the current situation in the league and where they are, they should be listening to like batten down the hatches, keep themselves as far away from bad publicity apart from what's on the pitch. You think just have a look like we're a close knit unit, we're working hard to get back to the top of the table, to go and do that. And then to have, you know, the backlash from one of the teams being furloughed, you just think it seems like a crazy decision from the club's point of view to be able to do it. And it's not even needed, realistically.
Okay, well, Stephen Kelly, thanks so much. Donica, we're going to be chatting rugby after this, and we might have to mention the France under-20 squad who went off to a warm weather training camp in Portugal and now have been hit with an outbreak of COVID, which is really interesting when you think it was them that were so vocal about calling a halt to the Champions Cup because of travel, and then their under-20s go off and do that. So we will be chatting about that after the break.
Snacking range available in selected Tesco, Super Value, and convenience stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Okay, as we were speaking about just before the break, Marie, it is interesting, rugby, an awful lot going on. There wasn't much action on the pitch, but off it there's been plenty going on, and we're delighted to be joined by Ben Coles from the Daily Telegraph. Ben, how are you?
Yeah, very well, guys. Hope you're well.
Yes, we're all good. Ben, it's a bit of a debate among myself and Ruby. The Lions has snowballed a little bit more, and Razzy Rasmus has jumped in today saying the Springboks will do whatever it takes to be involved in the Lions series.
Yeah, he has, and I guess almost the fact that he's saying that, it should almost be a bit of a concern for all of us. I think the fact that we're at this point where South Africa are coming out and say they're willing to consider all options just to get this tour off the ground has to put the fact that we're meant to be, you know, having this series in July and August take place, it sort of feels ever increasingly unlikely at this point, and that's why we're talking about options such as postponing the tour for a year or moving the tour to the UK. The chances of it going ahead on time don't look great. I think that has to be said, given the way that COVID-19 is developing in South Africa and also how it's going over here in the UK and in Ireland as well.
I think it was probably compounded by the fact that he was talking about COVID himself as well, Ben, and just even describing his symptoms, that he had it pretty bad. And, you know, Stephen still got a low heart rate, even though he has come out the other side of it.
Yeah, and actually I think that's really important, because I think in South Africa they sort of appreciate that the high profile people are sort of coming out and explaining that they've had COVID and sort of the symptoms they've been struggling with, because there's still a battle to sort of keep awareness sort of high and make sure that people are taking as many precautions as possible. Which is obviously awful news to hear that Razzy's had that, and you your best wishes go to him and his family, that they recover as quickly as possible. And it's been such an odd sort of 18 months since Africa won that World Cup, because they've not played a game. They sacrificed playing in the Rugby Championship so that they could sort of keep their plans sort of on track to get ready for this Lions series in July and in August. And now they're in a position where they won't have played a game. Say the series doesn't go ahead in July and August. In South Africa, like, who knows how long it will be until they play a test match again. It's an extraordinary situation for a team who are champions of the world to be in, really.
And we thought we would be sitting here in January and February and talking about hypothetical teams and trying to predict who's going to be playing, but I think we've probably had about four or five conversations at this stage about whether or not the Lions will go ahead. Do you have a timeline for when a decision is going to be made?
Well, I know that the organisers are sort of talking about what they're going to do in terms of contingency plans now. Originally, I don't think they were going to make a decision until the end of March, but actually it was quite clear a couple of weeks ago that this needed to be addressed sort of sooner rather than later, because there's so many sort of aspects to it. There's not only the hosting of the games in South Africa, but there's making sure that all the supporters who are meant to be travelling out there in their thousands are able to sort of go and that it's safe and all of the logistics that come with that. And of course, everything to do with the players and the teams. So those talks are happening now. And hopefully we will have an answer sort of by the end of January regarding what the solution is going to be. It's certainly a half-decent idea to potentially play it up here in the UK. Although, I mean, Donica's a better place than I am to talk about this. It takes away, I think, a lot of
what the Lions is about. He's anti it.
No circumstances whatsoever. He's in Brian Moore's
camp. It's just not... I just don't think... personally agree. I don't think it's right, because you just lose that aspect of the fact that you're touring and you're going to a different country as a group of players and you're trying to sort of bond together to produce something special, and I'm sure Donica will agree with that.
Ben, but it is a live option now, though. When you have Razzie saying they'll do whatever it takes, they will come. You heard Faf the clerk mentioning how he wants to play in this. Let's get the games on. So I think it has changed now that the South Africans are saying we're willing to travel.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think that sort of sums up the desperation of the situation, that they're willing to take a series or some matches away from South Africa, and let's not forget also how much of a money maker this is for the South African Rugby Union, just like it is for the New Zealand Rugby Union when the Lions go there, and the Australian Rugby Union as well. It's a huge sort of earner that comes around every 12 years because you have so many sort of fans travelling. Now, there's obviously questions about whether you could even have fans in games in South Africa because of COVID-19, and whether you'd be able to have the capacity in stadiums. There's just so many unknowns at the moment that I really do have a lot of sympathy for the organisers trying to work out what they're going to do with a tour that is meant to kick off in less than 6 months' time. But yeah, you're right. The fact that Razzie Erasmus has said, look, we will literally take whatever option is necessary and available to make this series happen, because they want to face the Lions, because it's the pinnacle of a Springboks career right up there with winning the World Cup, then yeah, that shows what a desperate state we're in, really.
Ben, and speaking of finances, CVC Holdings have purchased 14.5% of the commercial rights of the Six Nations. It's been questioned here in some quarters whether it's a good idea or not, but what is the general consensus in the UK?
I think the mood is sort of shared across the nations, which is that the investment comes at such an important time because of the fact that unions have been hit so hard by COVID-19 over the last year, losing out on so much match revenue, and therefore the match revenue, for example, with the RFU isn't just to go in the coffers that took him, and that then funds the grassroots sport, and it's such an integral part of it. So if there's a way to get extra investment and extra income, then I think all of the unions are going to snap whoever's hand off it is who's offering the money to be able to get that. And now this deal has sort of been signed off by the French, which means it looks like it's going to go through. I think it's for about £350 million. I mean, that's a huge sort of a bit of money at a time where rugby desperately needs a bit of support. So while, I don't know, while the ethics of it and while the sort of the reason why it's happened might not be met universally with praise by everybody, I think there's an appreciation that, you know, this is a desperate time for the sport where the more money they can get into it, the better, really.
Ben, we are tight in time. There was a bit of action on the pitch with the Scottish Derby, and Toulon went on the road to Racing, but it was more so Nick Green and Vakatau's incidents that are more appealing, weren't they?
Yeah, we loved it. It's nice when you get a blooper, and you very rarely get two on the same weekend. So I think you've got to drink, you've got to savour them, and you know, make sure that you enjoy them. I think Nick Groom sending a message to Scottish Rail about the fact that a train's horn made him think it was half time. He's used to those loud klaxons in South Africa. They normally tell you when it's half time or full time. He clearly thought that the passing train was telling him it was half time, and it led to him kicking the ball into touch early, which was brilliant. And the Vakatawa one, yeah, we've seen that happen so many times to so many players. There must be sort of an exclusive club that he's now part of, where he's had the ball sort of knocked out of his hands when he thought he scored. I imagine they get together quite regularly, all those players.
Yeah, absolutely. You say it to every defender, though, always challenge every ball, which was brilliant to see. Ben, thanks so much for joining us on Game On. That's it from us. A massive thank you to Ronan and Laura Lee. We're back tomorrow at 6:00.